This is tape one, side two, Lawrence Henderson interview, August 30th, 1989. We're interested in examining the transition of the role of director of the Project RAND to president of the corporation, and what role the board played in that process, if any, or whether there was anything of interest in that transition.
Well, it was an interesting situation, obviously. Frank had never had any experience as a, quote, corporate executive, if you see what I mean. He'd always been the principal technical advisor to Arthur Raymond, and together they developed the DC-3, which is the best airplane that has ever been designed, as far as I'm concerned, and still is. And they both had a very broad view of this, although they were both engineers. Both Arthur and Frank, and particularly Frank, was a tremendously imaginative guy, and he'd gotten involved in all sorts of things during the war that were what you would have said were outside the normal purview of an engineer at Douglas. He was interested in the atomic business and in radar and all sorts of things. When we set up the corporation, the first thing, we did not pick a president. There was no president. There was a director, and Frank was the director. And there was a long period, like a couple of years or a year and a half, something like that, anyway, where there was a debate about whether Frank should be the president, and the general consensus was, no, we've got to find somebody else to become president. And we went around, and in fact, a number of people were asked to be president, and they all turned it down, fortunately, as far as I'm concerned. These were people with a national reputation, fairly distinguished people. I don't want to get involved in who they were, but they were, you know, a number of us knew them. I don't know why we felt it was necessary to get somebody with a national reputation, except that we did. And I don't know how strongly we felt about this. I think all of us thought Frank was doing a great job, but for some reason, finally the great light dawned after like a year and a half, and we said to ourselves, come on, this is crazy. Frank is absolutely capable of doing this. He's very good. He knows how to handle contracts. He knows how to handle finances. He knows how to handle personnel. The outfit is running well. So he got to be president. And then the rest of us, Goldie and I, became vice presidents instead of associate directors and so on.
Yeah. When you say we, are you referring to the RAND staff, the Board of Trustees?
I'm talking about the Board of Trustees. Rowan Gaither and the Board of Trustees and Frank and Goldie and I, mainly, not the RAND staff, didn't have any input to it, as far as I know. I mean, we may have consulted some of them, you know, senior people like Gene Rood and John Williams, but no, this was being done by those of us who were, quote, concerned with the management.
For those who strongly, if anybody, strongly advocated getting somebody else to be president of the corporation, do you remember what arguments or reasons there were for doing that?
Well, I suppose the arguments were you'd like to get somebody with a national reputation. You'd like to get somebody who had some experience as an executive. Basically, that's it. Ed Bowles was one of the strongest people. He was sure that Frank couldn't manage the corporation. And that created some problems for us. Uh,
Did the Air Force staff that you dealt with have any feelings about it one way or the other?
I don't think we ever really discussed it seriously with the Air Force. We felt this was our business. It was the private business of the people running the corporation, the trustees and the management of the corporation. None of us had any feeling that there was any problem between Frank and the Air Force. I mean, Frank was widely respected in the Air Force. I don't have any feeling that there was that the Air Force had much input into this decision. Yeah, I would stand corrected if you can find some evidence of this. There may have been some contact, but mainly we were talking in our little group, the trustees and Ron Gaither.
Was the search for a candidate kind of a casual activity, or was it kind of a, you know, did you have a search committee and kind of...
No. I've been through that in other situations. Yeah. No, there was no search committee or anything of that sort. It was entirely casual.
How far did you get in looking for somebody? Did you actually go as far as, for instance, offering the post?
Yes, to two or three people who turned it down.
I know Lee DuBridge was, or it's been said that...
I think Lee was once offered, and of course he would have been crazy to take it. He was much better off as president of Caltech. And then there was a very distinguished guy at the Harvard Business School who was a close personal friend of mine who was offered the job, and there was a time when it looked as though he might take it, but he didn't.
Was this George Dorio?
Yes, George Dorio. I don't want to get involved in that. He's a close personal friend of mine, and he was a possibility. He was interested in RAND. He interested in the concept. Well, as you know, his activity with American Research and Development was, you know, the kind of imaginative thing that we were trying to do at RAND. And there may have been a couple of others. I can't offhand. I remember DuBridge and I remember Dorio. I can't remember who else might have been involved. There might have been some other people involved. But it wasn't awfully easy to find anybody. You could conceive of people who had a reputation but who wouldn't have wanted to leave. And you didn't want somebody who was an academic type necessarily. And you didn't want anybody who was strictly a businessman. You wanted somebody with a lot of flexibility, and I think both DuBridge and Dorio fitted that pattern.
Did Frank remain kind of low key during this, or was he pointedly in favor of one way or another?
I don't think he had any strong views on me. I mean, he was a very modest guy. Always had been a very personally very shy, modest guy. I think he had an open mind. I think he thought it would be very difficult to find somebody who had the right kind of imagination and flexibility to do the job. And in that sense, I think he was quite right. But I don't think he felt any personal, he didn't feel personally put upon because we were looking for somebody else. I think he started out with the notion that we ought to get somebody else. But I think as time went on, he began to feel, this is running all right, and so on. And the rest of us finally realized that we had a gem on our heads. It was crazy to go looking elsewhere. But it was all very informal. There was nothing fixed about it. The trustees and Rowan had an open mind on it. They had the same feeling that we did, that it was difficult to find the right guy, very difficult to find the right guy. Okay. And Frank turned out to be dandy.
As a way of proceeding from here, there are a number of points we want to cover, but I thought one way to kind of get a overview of many of the issues that are of interest to us would be to ask you to identify some of the key points or critical points in your relationship with the Air Force that pointed to some of the nature of the relationship between the corporation and the Air Force and the way you did business together?
Well, as I've mentioned earlier, the original key point was that neither the Air Force nor we really knew what kind of an animal RAND was supposed to be or would be. There were sections of the Air Force, particularly the technical people, the people at Wright Field, the people in the communications part of the Air Force, and as opposed to the operators, who felt that RAND was another contract with a good technical organization, and we have a lot of problems that we know about that we'd like to have RAND solve. And so they would write proposals for contracts in which would be the same thing that they used to write to engine manufacturers or radio developers or what have you. We want you to study this and come up with a development, a certain development. And every time this came up, it was vetoed by the Air Force policy people at the top. Not clear to me why they were sensible enough to do this, except I think at that point, Ed Bowles was very influential, particularly with the secretary and the chief of staff. And there were people at the top in the Air Force who were imaginative, Vandenberg, Norstad, these people, you know. And LeMay, in a curious sense, I think felt the same way. I think LeMay didn't have very much use for the Wright Field people. I think that was an important factor. Wright Field wasn't monolithic either, because Don Putt was at Wright Field, and he didn't feel that way. He felt it was interesting to have something imaginative and not the routine kind of thing. But that was the first and a continuing problem. Now, this problem continued for a long time, largely because they would say that they wanted reports every quarter in detail of what we were doing. They wanted us to give them briefings regularly, and this caused all sorts of problems because we were working on some things that were very long range in which we didn't really have anything to say every 3 months or every month or what have you. And so we'd have to concoct something, and this was a damn annoyance. And they tried to write into the contract all sorts of requirements for reports and reporting and this, that, and the other thing. And this was a constant source of annoyance between the people in the Air Force who wanted to run it like a quote Air Force project and us who wanted to try to run it like a freewheeling enterprise. And it's very understandable why they took this attitude. And even the non-Wright Field people, could understand why the Wright Field people wanted the development people, why they wanted to have this, quote, control. Now, they weren't trying to, having been told that they couldn't direct us to do things substantively, they were trying to direct us to do things organizationally and bureaucratically. That was the basic conflict. And over a period of years, we resolved this by sticking to our guns. And
did the RAND, I've heard about and seen references to a RAND Dayton office.
Yes, that's
some
right.
Some sort of an office at Wright.
This was much later. We had no office then. And when we had an office in Dayton, the problems that I've been just talking about were over. There was no problem at that point.
And So the office. The Dayton was you Dayton didn't, office. You didn't put an office there in order to have a presence.
No.
No. Just to manage this.
No, sir.
Sort of stave off this kind of.
It's my impression we did not. It was my impression that was put my responsibility in Washington. Okay. And of course the people in Santa Monica. For a long time, we didn't have any Air Force officers stationed at RAND. That came later, too. I think we resisted that at first. We didn't want somebody looking over a shoulder all the time, some junior guy, you know, writing back to the general saying, look, they're doing this and it's crazy. Like subscribing to the Morning Telegraph, you know, to get the odds on racism, things that we used to do that created all sorts of problems that John Williams had a ball criticizing.
Okay, so this one critical area of interaction is this question of proper reporting and the
yes,
organizational
yes,
requirements yes, placed on RAND.
Yes, that's right.
What other...
And who we would report to. Of course, that was the very first decision was we reported to LeMay as Deputy Chief of Air Staff for Research and Development, which was a maverick office at that time. It wasn't part of the regular development thing. It was a separate kind of office. It later was abolished, and they set up the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff Development, which was on the par with all the other deputy chiefs of staff. But originally, LeMay was in a superior position to the regular air staff organization. It was a different situation, kind of like a special assistant, I suppose.
So we were trying to get at a kind of summation of the yeah. of critical yeah. points in the Air Force
well,
other, relationship.
Well, there was a critical point that came up in Frank's, that you have a copy of, Frank's long report of the episode with the senior officers board at the time of the first major report on air bomber, choice of bombers. And the senior officers board wanted us to tell them what they ought to do. This is very curious, you know. It's just kind of the reverse thing, and we, with the advice of some of our very bright friends in the Air Force, said, "Don't get trapped into this. Don't do it. Your report is fine. It's very useful as information, and so on. But it isn't. The decision should be a decision by the Air Force, not by RAND." And they're exactly right about that. But that was a very, very interesting controversy. Wright Field didn't want us making the decision. LeMay, he was in the Strategic Air Command, didn't want us making the decision. But the Senior Officers Board in Washington, the Air Staff, did. And we knew that if we tried to make a flat recommendation, that we would have been cut to ribbons by the people at SAC and Wright Field, and they would have been right. So that was one controversy. We cannot assume that a RAND study is the be-all and end-all of the solution to a problem. It can throw light on the solution to a problem, but it's not the solution. And so even when we made, quote, recommendations to the air staff, they essentially said, look, you ought to consider this seriously. Not, you ought to do this, but more, you should consider it seriously. Later controversies had to do with what kinds of things we should study. You know, the controversy about setting up the social science division and the economics division. Then later there was the political controversy about what other agencies in the government could we properly work for apart from the Air Force. Well, we started out with the AEC. That was no problem because the AEC and the Air Force were, you know, working together, and there was no feeling that the AEC was going to interfere with the Air Force's decisions or anything of that sort, and that it would be useful to have access. A lot of the Air Force people didn't have access to some of the things that the AEC was doing that we eventually did get access to, because we had a lot, we had people who were helping Los Alamos, you know, in their work, that kind of thing. But when we started to think about the fact that we ought to be doing some work or working with or giving, making our reports available to the Office of the Secretary of Defense when it was set up, that got to be a major controversy. And it was very...
So this this was a controversy before you even started doing contract work for them, but just providing them with information.
Oh, yes, yes. It started, yeah, sure. It started along those lines. And, of course, that got involved in the question of freedom of dissemination of reports in a general sense. You know, it's, who can have access to our reports? Are these private communications between us and the Air Forces, you know, or are they things that should be made available to the scientific community or the military community in general? Well, we worked most of that out. We did get, so most of our reports were being distributed. But then the question came up of the fact that the Air Force was no longer able to make decisions on its own that would, were on subjects that would be affected by RAND studies. And that was when we got into the question of should we work for parts of the Defense Department that were, this mainly had to do with policy. It was the original controversy was the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs wanted us to do work for them. And that's an area that the plans people in the Air Force felt was extremely sensitive. They didn't want us to get involved in that kind of thing. There weren't very many controversies with respect to the research and development part of the whole defense thing. In other words, if we did some work on a material or we did some work on a kind of engine or something of that sort, research, there was no controversy really about making that available to the people in at the Defense Department level. I think the Air Force didn't feel threatened by that in a sense. But the minute you started to get into the policy area, into planning or programming or this kind of thing, it was they felt that their position as decision makers was being threatened, and that if we wrote a report that they didn't like and it went to the Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs, the next thing they knew the Secretary of Defense would be ramming it down their throat, and they just couldn't sit still for this, they thought. We kept saying, look, you'd be better off if we did work for them, because then some of the ideas that you have and that we have together on which we agree will get a better hearing up at higher levels. Well, that argument had some merit, and it has a lot of merit today, but in those days they were, you know, they weren't impressed by that. They thought that was a bunch of talk.
What about within the Air Force itself?
Yeah.
Was there any set of considerations that you had to work out in terms of who within the Air Force could have access to the reports?
Not very much, as I recall it. Not very much. There were a few sensitive things that we worked on that they didn't want to have spread around the commands, for example. But I don't think that was much of a problem. In that sense, the Air Force is pretty monolithic. In other words, it doesn't they're not worried about somebody down at Langley Field getting access to a recommendation to the air staff, for example. Just because they felt that they could control that was they could operate with that.
When did
not that there weren't controversies between the commands and the air staff with respect, not only with respect to RAND reports, but with respect to all sorts of other things.
When did this issue of a concern about sharing RAND reports with the Department of Defense senior management come into play? What time period are we talking about?
Boy, that's the kind of chronological question which I am just very vague on. I couldn't tell you. I'm sure, you know, if you could cite me some individual examples, I could say, yes, that was one of them or it wasn't. But
actually working at the Office of Secretary of Defense level is a phenomenon that I think comes in around.
Yes, sure.
So that's when the contract issue comes in. But
that's when the contract issue came in.
The information would be talking like early 50s?
Yeah, probably early 50s, yeah, something like that, where there were, for example, we had a document that we got, I don't know whether it still exists, called a recommendation to the air staff. Now, that never would have been circulated to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. But if we wrote a technical report that related to that, it would be circulated to the Research and Development Board and the Army and the Navy, you know, in a regular way, just as a matter of technical information, you know, freedom of scientific exchange, and so on. And that never really created much of a problem. Oh, there were individual cases that. Not of any real interest. A few individual cases where somebody would scream and say, you know, get that report back, and so on. And we'd say, no way, you know, so on. But it wasn't that wasn't much of a problem. The problem was at the policy level, as you say, when it got to be 58, 59, or whenever we started to work for people in the Defense Department whom the Air Force regarded as interfering with their decision-making powers. Okay. And, of course, our attitude was, if we stay with the Air Force and don't work for them, we're not going to be able to affect the kinds of decisions that are going to attract good people to RAND, and, you know, that kind of thing.
One area that I'd just like to flag so that we can get back to it at some point is the development of formal review procedures at every stage of a study's existence.
Yeah.
And how it was determined who was going to get to see it and who wasn't, and where it was going to go and where it wasn't, and just how those procedures evolve. We've seen in Brownlee's papers a number of documents that talk about the institution and also the revision and review of all of these various procedures, and also problems, even down to the problem of individual analysts who might want to slip a draft of something that you're working on to various places. At some point, I'd like to without interrupting the general issues we're talking about now, I'd like to get back to this and see how the specific
communication.
Larry, I guess just sort of set the background for that a little bit. One other question that I want to point you towards is just a quick outline of your key points of contact in the Air Force over periods of time. First, you reported to LeMay. And then where were your key points of contact after that?
Well, after that office got some of its functions taken away from them, it was then being run by Major General R.C. Wilson, who was a good friend, and they transferred the Project RAND contract, contact at that point, to the Deputy Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff Development, which, as I say, was then a standard part of the Air Staff. It was, you know, plans and operations, development, materiel, and, you know, personnel, so on. And we were unhappy with that. I remember the time when General Wilson told me they were going to do that. I said, "Good God, you're selling us down the river." You know, he was a close personal friend. And he said, no, it's going to work all right. Don't worry. We'll support you. The rest of us will support you from the outside. We won't let them screw things up for you." And I said, "Well, you know, those people are, a lot of them have right field background, and they believe in running things like a railroad, and that's not the way we run." And he said, "Yeah, I know this." He did. He was very, very bright, imaginative. Although he had come from right field originally, but he was a very imaginative guy. So then we went to work for, I don't know, General Craigie, I guess. I forget who was the Deputy Chief of Staff Development at that time. But we worked with them, and they set up this development planning office in their shop, and we never had as much trouble as I thought we were going to have as a result of that change.
And has that been the principal place of yeah. contact for RAND since?
Yeah. It depends on what you mean. That's the administrative contact. The people who keep records of reports and approve the sending of reports to various places, and they're the secretary for the Air Force Advisory Group at RAND, and, you know, they do the administrative stuff. Now, the principal points of contact are the people whose function it is to be interested in what you're studying. Now, this could be plans, it could be programming, it could be materiel, it could be personnel. There was no inhibition about talking to the different parts of the Air Staff or even different people in the field. There never has been any problem about that. I mean, we'd go around seeing anybody we wanted to. And we had plenty of access. There was no inhibition about that. But there was an administrative office whose job it was to see that the contract requirements were met and that reports were made available and that kind of thing. So we would normally, if we wanted to come in with something important, we would normally touch base with that office and say, "Look, we're going to go see the director of plans on this subject," and they'd say, "Fine." There was never any problem there. I worked with all these people all around the Air Staff. My contacts were not just with the RAND office in the Deputy Chief of Staff Development, but with the other Deputy Chiefs of Staff and with the directors that were relevant.
Now, a little unclear on where Don Putt's role fits in. During this early period, he headed up this Directorate of Research and Development. I believe it was in the Deputy Chief of Staff Materiel.
That's right. And then it became the Deputy Chief of Staff Development, and I think he became Deputy Chief of Staff Development.
Right.
It was originally under Materiel, and they separated it out and moved it up. That's right. I think... It may be that at the time General Wilson told me about this decision, that it was still that the development people were R&D were still under Materiel, and General Craig was the Deputy Chief of Staff Materiel, and General Craigie was the Director of Research and Development. Well, I'd known General Craigie in Europe as an operational commander, so that was no problem. General Craig was an old line. Right field materiel guy, but he was getting on and he wasn't interested in RAND, and so we didn't have any problem with him. And then they moved it and it became development, and then there was a whole succession of people who were more strong-minded, like General Saville, who, again, had been a friend of mine in Europe, and I thought he was first class, and we could argue like mad, you know, back and forth across the table and insult each other and so on. We just got along fine. And I always admired him. He did something in Europe which I really admired. He engaged in an act which, if it hadn't been in the Air Force, would have been resulted in a court-martial, I think, an act of complete insubordination, and he was exactly right. And it later turned out that he was right. This had to do with the bombing of Cassino, which was a major issue. I mean, everybody was involved, Eisenhower and Churchill and so on and so forth. And he was ordered to, he was running the tactical Air Force at the time in Italy, and he was ordered to engage in this operation. He says, I won't do it. It's a total mistake. It will be a disaster. And he described what it was me. And his commander, General Acre, was the theater commander at the time, said, Gordon, you know, the president has approved this. The prime minister has approved this. We're going to do it. And Gordon said, it's a total disaster. I won't have anything to do with it. I refuse to do it. So Acre, being smart enough to do this, says, okay, you take 2 weeks leave and go to Cairo. And that's what happened. And Gordon said, before I leave, I'm going to write you a piece of paper about what's going to happen when this operation takes place. And it will describe what will be a total disaster. And he wrote it all down, and he got Acre to seal it in an envelope and put it in a safe. And he went off to Cairo, and the operation went ahead, and it happened exactly as Saville had predicted. It was a total disaster. And Saville came back, and they opened the envelope, and there it was. There wasn't anything anybody could do about it at that point. It was, you know, it was all over. But, he was a very bright, able guy, and he knew how to use air power. And some of these people just didn't understand what the problems and limitations are. And he also, he understood the ground operation. And it was one of the, I think, a real fine act of courage and good sense. He was an interesting fellow, very interesting fellow. Unfortunately, he just recently died.
Did any RAND staff sit at this RAND office in the Office of Development?
Yeah, there was a period when we had quite a few people in there, yeah. Not actually in that office, but helping. General Schriever, when he became DCS Development, asked for some help, and there was a time when we had people in the air staff. I don't know that we do now. I don't, probably not, but, you know, it's going up and down. There was nobody there when I was, during most of my tenure in Washington. But then in the, I'd say, the 60s, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, we had people in the air staff.
I guess, and I recall in talking with George Tanham for a while, he served as something called a RAND liaison to the development office. Is that the same thing that you're talking about here?
Well, more or less, yes, he was in there for a while, yeah. But his interests were operational too, like mine. Not technical. He's not a technical man at all. He's a historian by training.
Right.
And so he was the people he liked to associate with were the same people I liked to associate with, the plans and operations people. And because he spent a fair amount of time in Vietnam, in
right.
the same. Kind of capacity.
Were these people under your supervision? Were they? Did they report to you in some sense?
Well, in some sense, I didn't bother them. If there were people there who were doing technical work or relating to work that was going on in Santa Monica, I didn't direct them on a daily basis or anything of that sort.
Okay.
It was a very freewheeling operation, as far as I was concerned. In fact, at that point, they were supposed to be working for the Development Planning Office in DCS Development.
I think we've set some of the RAND context and got a better picture of how the Air Force side of it was organized. And maybe we can pursue Joe's question now about the maturation of reports and how they were reviewed and then brought to the attention of the Air Force. Did you have some lead-in question on that point, Joe, that you wanted to...
It's a big topic. And in order to get down to something specific, maybe you could characterize how, for instance, draft reports and other written pieces of information that were going somewhere. When would they come by you? For what purpose? How would you deal with them? There's clearly you in the Washington office had some review
that's right.
powers over these things.
That's right. And, yeah, that's right.
I was just going to say, before you respond, let me just flip put a new tape in. Yeah.